Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to our podcast. Sorry we were away last week. It was industrial action, all that kind of thing, but
then
we're back.
Comrades, come rally.
Yeah, right.
And the last fight, let us face.
Okay, welcome to the podcast. You might want to just fast forward through that first bit. Sorry about that. Mark singing various socialist tunes is not really anyone's idea of fun. What do we have coming up in the next sort of swift few moments?
We have reviews of Skyline, Afternoons with Marguerite, We Are What We Are, and of course special guest appearances by...
So yes, star-studded Colin Farrell and Jason Isaacs will be turning up in this extraordinary edition of Wittertainment. Nice to be back. Thank you very much. We are being live streamed. I imagine that's why all the lights are on. There's no other decent reason for showing this fully illuminated.
And the last time we saw each other, it was less than fully illuminated because it was last night, in which we went together to the cinema in a rare occurrence. In fact, we went...
Joint appearance of the Commodian family and the Mayo family. And sitting next to each other with my youngest sitting next to your younger.
Yes.
And discussing the film, which we should have recorded and broadcast instead of our ramblings.
We should have done. But by the time we came out, it was darkness incorporated because the screening didn't start. It was a screening of the Harry Potter movie and it didn't start
Harry Potter 7A.
Harry Potter 7A. And it didn't start till quite late because before the film, I don't know about you, Simon, but I felt that the premiere was definitely boosted by the guys from Warner Brothers talking to us for a long time.
Yeah, there were some chief executives from Warner's Worldwide, and it went a bit like this. Just like to say thank you very much to everyone. So, okay. So I think, see, 30 points. Give a round of applause.
Yay!
Who are we applauding? I don't know who these people are, but then. So we had half an hour of that, and then...
Actually, what it was more like was, hey, your franchise, yeah, great, your wonderful, amazing journey, franchise, journey, amazing franchise, wonderful, England, America, love, England, franchise, wonderful, Joe, oh, Harry Potter, franchise, that was what it was like.
We had a special round of applause for the woman who is responsible for keeping the Harry Potter franchise going. How difficult must that be? That must be a really difficult... Because no one's interested.
Isn't that Joe Rowling? Isn't that who that is?
I don't know.
I mentioned it only in passing.
Anyway, so that went on for about half an hour, 35 minutes. It's tough when you get invited to premieres, let me tell you. And then we really suffer for
it. Then the stars came on and were on for 2 minutes and Rupert Grint did the best of all speeches. He went, it's great, hope you think it's great. That was great. That was a proper speech.
That was all. Anyway, in a fit of enthusiasm, we booked It was a very difficult booking, but we have one of the stars of Harry Potter in the studio. It could be absolutely anybody, but it's more likely to be the one that's on your address
my
list.
Speed dial.
Yes, exactly. So Lucius Malfoy will be with us. We think after 2:30.
You were hugging him on the red carpet.
Well, no, let me
put
that in some kind of context. I arrived late due to my Radio 2 commitments and arrived after
everybody
else.
Is it All Hits Friday today?
Or Request Friday? All Effects Friday. Call in and choose a special effect.
Actually, whatever. You should do that.
We should do that. We should do an All Special Requests Movie Effect Friday.
Okay.
We need a bank for it. Don't do it now because we haven't got them, but we should definitely work that up.
Okay.
Any special effect that you want, we'll try and sort. Anyway, so I arrive late, and I then walk past Jason, who's being interviewed for some TV thing. He breaks off from the interview to embrace me, and then I carry on in. So that's why.
Yeah. Because that's how famous you are.
Well, he was embracing everybody, but, you know, that's
he
the
thing. Embrace me.
Anyway, so we're expecting Jason Isaacs after 2:30. We are also expecting Colin Farrell in the next 6 or 7 minutes.
Okay, and we should say firstly of the Colin Farrell film, which you have been to see, but
London Boulevard.
I've been seeing the week's new releases. You've been catching up with London Boulevard, so I will leave.
I'm catching up on next week's releases.
Next week's releases. That's right. So I will leave the handling of London Boulevard to you.
Yes, that's right. Indeed.
Since you've seen it.
No, but you also know Colin Farrell. You are aware of his work.
Yes, no, I can talk to him about other things other than that in the allotted time. But obviously you've seen London Boulevard and I haven't. And also, can I say at the top of the show, of this week's top 10, the only one that's outstanding after our absences is at number 10, Birkenhair. So we need a little capsule, short couple of sentences of Birkenhair.
Okay. Now, we should also say that the much-awaited code of conduct, we were going to announce it today and we did say we were going to do it today. Because of... Mr. Farrell and because of Mr. Isaacs and because we've got 2 weeks of movies to catch up on because we weren't here last week.
And we will, during the top 10, be reviewing, for example, we'll do Jackass and we'll do the Mike Lee and we'll do Let Me In, Let Me Out.
So the Code of Conduct is still ongoing. Thank you very much indeed for all the participation. We're going to have an all singing, all dancing poster for you to cut out and keep and treasure, fold it in your wallet and deliver it at key moments of your life. Mm-hmm. And that will be all ready to go on next week's programme. So, thank you very much for the extraordinary number of emails. A number of people disappointed at how benign you've been recently.
Benign I've been?
Yes. Tim from Solihull, summing up here, say, I've been extolling the virtues of your programme to my wife for some time, not only from a shared love of film, but also the joy of hearing the good doctor going off on one. To wit, a commodian rant. To the disgust of my wife, the doctor has been on disappointingly good, even amiable behaviour for the last 3 weeks. So what he's done is he's tried to create, this is Tim in Solihull, he's created a perfect storm, which would, if it ever took place, guarantee a rant of extraordinary proportions.
Okay.
This is what needs to happen. Mark arrives at his favourite cinema, but this time has to take a lift to the seat.
Which is bad. I have a total phobia of lifts.
Okay. He's shown to his seat by an usherette dressed as a clown. His seat is occupied, and the only one left is on the right towards the back, surrounded by the worst offenders on the 10 cinema etiquette offender wanted list. The film starts badly projected, with popping sound, and the house lights barely dimmed.
Yeah.
It's Un Film de Michael Bay, a reworking of The Exorcist, an improved version, the original masterpiece, but with added colourisation, retro-dimensionalised, with added scenes featuring Julian Sands and Shia LaBeouf, including a musical montage and a gag reel. What do you think? I mean, there's lots more of that, but it's pretty good.
I think that's very good. Can I just say, my favourite bit of that, though, was your use of the word dimension. We should definitely use that because the word is dimensionalized, but dimensionalized is actually what putting 3D, retrofitting 3D does. It dimensionalizes it.
That's why I thought I'd
create
that word.
That's why you did it. Yes, it wasn't a stumble.
Luke McManus in Dublin. All right, Luke. On hearing that Mark is unnaturally excited by people passing out in the cinema, this is all part of the code of conduct.
Yeah.
Thing. I thought you might enjoy this from the Galway film Flower, where a friend of mine was innocently attending the premiere of hardcore Irish indie pick Savage.
Okay.
My friend was so overwhelmed by the visceral violence being dished out on screen by Darren Healy that she swooned, as a Victorian lady novelist might have put it. Unfortunately, the first person she saw when she regained consciousness was none other than actor Darren Healy himself, who was in attendance and had been the first person to her aid. She screamed and promptly fainted again. Has this ever happened before, to your knowledge? That would be an extraordinary thing, wouldn't
it? That would be great. The only thing I can think of that's comparable is that when Joaquin Phoenix totaled his car in LA, the car turned over and he came to find Werner Herzog looking in through the window going, "You are all right. You are all right." Which is the point at which you think, I have actually passed over onto the Bavarian side.
All right, so thank you for, I think the only other one that I can think of on that was Anthony Hopkins, or as he's known,
Sir Anthony Hopkins,
who in Silence of the Lambs made a point, he says, of going around small town cinemas, watching it, and then turning round. You know, or if people were talking, tapping them on the shoulder, they turn round and they see him there in his full glory.
Well, you know the Linda Blair Alice Cooper story, of course.
Yes, I do. But do you know what? Throw another log on the fire.
I'll do it.
Gather around the old Joanna and do it again.
I'll do it very quickly. Alice Cooper took Linda Blair to see The Exorcist because they became friends. And Linda Blair didn't want to watch The Exorcist because she was in it. And Alice Cooper kept talking all the way through, saying, "How do they do that? How do they do that? Is that pea soup? Is that a magnetic field? You know, is that a dummy? How do they do that?" And Linda Blair was sort of like, "No, I don't want to talk. And then the person in front decided that they were fed up with the people talking behind. So this does tie into the code of conduct. Turn round to tell them to shut up. Turn round one way, it was Alice Cooper. Turn round the other way, it was Linda Blair. Decided better.
Dougie in Coventry. I agree with most of the draconian rules that you've been supplying for your code of conduct, although I think having a bit of popcorn is part of the cinema experience.
Popcorn in the premiere last night. It was on the seats when you arrived there.
Was it noisy popcorn?
Well, all popcorn is noisy by its very nature, but there was a lot of popcorn around, so it was like you were being actively encouraged. And I have to say that there was a lot of popcorn eating.
Anyway, Dougie continues. I would like to add a positive rule. In any cinema which still has curtains that close between adverts and film, and all cinemas should, someone must, preferably audibly, make the old joke, "Well, that was a short film." It's not a trip to the cinema without it. What do you think of that?
I think it's right. Every time there's a critic screening, and every time the thing will start up and the projector breaks down, somebody says, you know, that was shorter than
I
thought.
Now we're on Colin Farrell alert. Let me talk about Colin Farrell because his new movie is London Boulevard. However, it may well be that the last thing that you saw him in was Crazy Heart, in which he put in a rather fine performance. Let me just play a little bit of one of the key songs from Crazy Heart. It starts like this.
It's the Dodge Brothers, isn't it?
Could well be the Dodge Brothers. It sounds good, doesn't it? Bit of a long intro.
Yeah.
But he gets there.
But at Radio 1, you'd talk all over this bit. You'd say, and now coming up to the top of the hour, here comes Sting. OK. I was born on a flat top Tulane. Picked up a guitar and every day I'd sing till I was gone. Gone, gone, gone.
Now, this is for all the world, true 100% Nashville, yes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. This is Colin Farrell singing Crazy Heart, and he puts in a fantastic performance. So that is Nashville, that's Colin Farrell doing an American twang and doing it fantastically. In London Boulevard, however, the feeling is slightly different.
I'm not going back inside, Billy, ever, for no one. Then don't get caught.
I might have a job for you. Are you handy?
What, with hammers and such? It's me, remember?
How'd you get this number?
You really think I'm gonna let you all free around this planet? He said you owe him.
I don't owe him anything.
You're a gangster. You're part of my firm.
There are other things I can do, and maybe I want to do them.
If I fell in love with you, what would you do about it?
Everything.
You and me could be great. People will remember us.
You don't want me to be a gangster. Nobody wants me to be a gangster, because I could not stop if I started. You'll be the first to die.
So there's a variety of voices in there. Ray Winston, a lot of Ray Winston in there, some Ben Chaplin. So now, having heard the many voices of Colin Farrell, we need to hear the true voice of Colin Farrell. Will the real Colin say, hello, Mark and Simon?
Hello, Mark and Simon.
Now we're into cartoon voiceover mode.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Hello, Colin, how
hello.
Are you?
How's it going, lads? You
well, look, Dan, we've just...
Thanks for that lead-in. That's most kind.
Listen, that Crazy Heart soundtrack is on in the car and in my house.
Are you serious?
The whole time. I absolutely love the film.
And are you usually a fan of country, or is it just an exception?
No, I do like country. And, you know, T-Bone Burnett on a record guarantees it in our house. Everything in our house is at the moment produced by T-Bone Burnett.
He's got so much goodwill built up over the years. And I know it's justified with all the stuff that he's been attached to. It's amazing, really.
Did
I mean,
actually produce that song?
He did, yeah. No, I was in the studio with him. Yeah, I remember Brendan Gleeson telling me about being in the studios with T-Bone and Alison Krauss when they were doing the soundtrack for Cold Mountain with Anthony Minghella, Lord rest him. But yeah, I was in the studio with T-Bone Burnett and with Ryan, who wrote the song The Weary Kind, Ryan Bingham, who won the Oscar and the Golden Globe.
What a fantastic song.
It was so much
song,
fun, lads. Yeah, I mean, it was make-believe for a day, you know.
So were you like pretending, and the reason I'm doing all this is, you know, because clearly the people behind you with headphones on are going, he needs to talk about London Boulevard, not talk about the old. The reason I'm doing it is because the London accent.
The good
accent
thing about
is,
headphones is nobody knows what we're talking about, so you're golden.
Oh, exactly.
Go ahead, carry
on. Right, so let's talk about Crazy. Is that I would imagine it's a lot of people's fantasy, you know, to put on that hat, to stand up in front. Was it a Toby Keith concert that you were.
Yeah, it was. There was.
And to be a country star. To be a country star.
It was a bit nerve wracking. To be honest with you, I was in a heap because I just finished a film with Neil Jordan on the west of Ireland playing a fisherman. So I got off the boat, onto a plane, off the plane, onto a stage, and I didn't have too much time to contemplate it or get too nervous about it. But the concert, the Toby Keith concert, 14,000 people was just so much fun. Myself and Jeff running on and off. They gave us 12 minutes in between the warm-up band and Toby Keith coming out. They gave us 12 minutes, so they had four cameras, and we got two run-throughs, two songs, and that was it.
And Mark here, who likes a bit of country Billy,
I like a bit.
You thought it was so good that it was dubbed.
No. My assumption was it must have been dubbed because it was so convincingly spot on. I mean, I was really genuinely impressed.
That's lovely. Thanks. That's second career.
No, but anyway, that's a really backhanded compliment, is it? It sounded so good. I thought it must be somebody else.
No, which we didn't. Which
oh,
we didn't
you see,
like
my ego demand went straight to the fact that you thought it was dubbed by me, which of course it was. I wasn't singing live.
Yeah, no. But it is. No, it's fantastic. It's really
Glenn Close.
So now, what we see right at the very beginning of this is you you pop out of Pentonville,
yeah,
and instantly you're gangster geezer. So tell us about Mitchell, Colin.
Mitchell is, as you said, he's after putting in 3 years in Pentonville, and he comes out and basically is trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life, but he knows he doesn't want to do what he did and the things that he did and the way he lived his life that got him in there in the first place. He wants to make some changes, but of course he's someone who's reaching into a future that he's designed in his mind, and the past is kind of has a tight grip of him and won't let him go, you know. He's someone that didn't grow up in an environment of crime, I don't think. I think he grew up, you know, I hate to talk about class systems, but in what would be termed a middle to upper class house. And he just realised at a young age that he was very good at violence, and he made some money for a few years doing that and wants to make some changes.
Because it's not actually spelt out precisely what you have been doing.
No, not at all, not at all. I mean, you can just, you know, you can run the gamut from, you know, being an enforcer, debt collector and bits and pieces. All around top man, but trying to make some changes. And then he meets Kira's character, Charlotte, and he kind of begins to fall in love with her. And so he's fractured between the life that he used to live and the life that he wants to live. And, you know, he's caught up in one while really the book on the other one isn't closed yet, you know.
How really, really difficult must it have been to film the love sequences with Keira Knightley?
To pretend to be fond of Keira Knightley was an awful stretch for an untalented individual like my good self. She's a dream to work with, man, to be honest. I would have liked to have had more scenes with her.
I'm sure you would.
Yeah, funny that. Yeah. Selfish that I am. Greed being an attribute that I acquired at a very young age. Everything, yeah, generous, smart, really decent, creative. Just pick a good adjective, and she's it, I suppose.
I mentioned just after we heard the trailer that the cast list, apart from yourself, Keira Knightley, David Thewlis. How much did he in David Thewlis's character is just fantastic.
It's brilliant.
Oh, you saw it, lads. The top actor.
Yeah. He, an over the top actor, imagine. I wonder how much David had to stretch for that one. He was genius. Genius to watch him every take. I mean, he was so flamboyant and so, but still grounded and just an amazing cast.
Yeah, Anna Friel, Ben Chaplin, Ray Winston, Eddie Marsden, and Sanjeev Bhaskar, Stephen Graham,
Olivia Lovett-Bond, and all the crew that came in for a line here and there and a day here and there were just genius. Everyone across the board was amazing. I was the only blow-in, and yeah, it was a place of privilege to be part of it.
Can you explain the title?
The term blow-in.
London Boulevard. Is it a reference to Sunset Boulevard?
It is a reference to Sunset Boulevard, and that that conceit was a lot more significant in the book, in Ken Bruin's book. It's a crime novel, based on a crime novel written by Ken Bruin, that took the same structure. An older, reclusive actress and a young man who, instead of William Holden's writer, was a gangster, Mitchell. But in the film, they made the character a lot younger and the relationship changed a lot. But yes, it's modelled somewhat loosely after Sunset Boulevard in that relationship.
Now, the guy who's directed this, William Monaghan, is it his first time?
It's his first time directing, yeah. Obviously, he's a screenwriter and he won the Oscar for adapted screenplay for The Departed. And this is the first time he's directed. Yeah, it was a blast. He's great. Great.
At any stage, do you get slightly more nervous because he hasn't done one before?
Not really, man. I've been in some films with some very experienced directors who kind of missed the mark, and I've been in films with first-time directors who've hit bullseye. You just never know. One of the good things about the gig is it defies all kind of scientific rationale. You know, there's no measurement for success, or else we'd all be doing deadly. Not that I'm doing too shabby.
If you look back over your CV, I mean, recent things, you know, Ondine, Imaginarium, Dr. Parnassus, obviously were you one of the people that came in to save Terry Gilliam from that terrible situation, New World, but the thing that really stands out in the middle of all that is in Bruges, the amount of people who were genuinely impressed, and also, I mean, I saw in Bruges a couple of times. First time I saw it, I was really knocked out by just how scabrous and fantastically rude that dialogue is. Tell us about doing that.
Yeah, it was fun. Absolute license, man, to be as insulting and un-PC as one could possibly hope to be in one's adult life. It was a blast every day, you know. It was great dialogue. Martin's just a master, really. Just a master wordsmith. And Brendan Gleeson, the two of us buzzing off each other. I was in heaven doing that gig. It was like a play, you know, we're in Bruges. You pick up the cameras and walk 400 yards down the road to shoot the next scene. You know, it was like the whole town was a large film set.
Did you ever get the sense with any of those lines that oh no, actually I can't say that. That's stepping over the line slightly too far.
Oof. It's dangerous, you know, you get into talk about stepping over the line too far. I mean, it's basically representing in however a real or surreal way, but it's representing, you know, language and life that some people somewhere live as individuals or cumulatively. So not really. I mean, there was a couple of things I knew I'd get I knew I'd get picked up on, but I kind of had to come to my own rationale for saying them, and I was fine with it. No.
In terms of that line, it's worth saying about London Boulevard, I imagine it's an 18 certificate, because not just the violence, but there's racist language. I mean, it's a real full-on gangster
film.
There's some stuff
in there, that's some dialogue that's fairly tough. I mean, there's a lot of violence as well that's very explicit, but some of the dialogue is, so Ray is some crackers.
That's true, but he's enjoying every single minute of it, isn't he? I remember reading that you went on, I think it was for Triage, that you had a ridiculous diet.
Have an unhealthy diet for Triage, I should have got tested for mercury poisoning. I just ate tins of tuna every day, really. Well, not
what was
tins,
your calorie
plural.
Limit?
Went anywhere between, I suppose, 300 and 800.
A day?
Yeah, for a while.
So
drinking lots of water and taking a few vitamins, but
well, you're looking fine form for London Boulevard. Were you given any instructions about?
Not at all. No instructions for that. I mean, the triage thing was very explicit in the book and in the script that he came back a ghost of himself. London Boulevard, no, whatever. Give pizza and
but in the back of your mind, you're thinking, if I've got to be in bed with Keira Knightley, I don't want to look like a sack of potatoes.
Correct. That was exactly. Actually, that was the whole reason to do the gig.
And we see you on. I know it's the Graham Norton show. Is it the TV show or is it the radio show that you're on?
It's the TV show.
The TV show.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that. Yeah. Colin, really appreciate you speaking to us. Thanks very much indeed.
Take care. Have a good
day.
And
do a country album. Do a country album properly.
I'm thinking of it now. I'm going to call Nashville now. My speed dial number 3.
Colin, thanks very much indeed. Colin Farrell speaking to us about London Boulevard. And that you'd love the Crazy Heart soundtrack.
I've got the Crazy Heart soundtrack, Simon.
You could have chipped in then when I was singing its praises. You could have said, well,
Simon,
I agree with you.
You know,
Simon.
It's very difficult to get a word in edgeways when you go, I love it, 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 how much I love it, it's what I love it.
You're trying to suggest that I've turned into Danny Dyer.
No, but it is, Jan, it is absolutely that thing about, but when I saw it, thinking, I know that's Jeff Bridges doing his record, but that must be somebody else doing a dub on it, because it is uncannily accurate. But I think an awful lot of it also does have to do with T-Bone Burnett, who, of course, is apparently very, very tall.
Is he?
Hello. No, sorry, I'm talking to you, but you're looking the other way because you're more interested in other people coming in the room.
Well, who wouldn't be?
Yes.
Who wouldn't be?
You have to tell the nation who's here, then.
A Death Eater. He's just a random Death Eater. Could
Hello,
be any.
Jason.
Hello, lovely boys. I didn't mean to interrupt, sorry. I was looking for Colin Farrell. I'm looking everywhere under the desk.
He's down at some swanky hotel.
I'll bet he is.
I think he is.
Having a good time.
And he deserves it.
Did you have a good time last night?
It's a surreal thing. You're referring, obviously, to the Harry Potter premiere, and it's a...
That's what it was. And you had Johnny Wayne chocolate.
That's where it was.
I did. I went to the chocolate fountain. I made that where I based myself and talked to everyone who came by there, mostly young people, surprisingly. It's an odd thing, I've said, being an actor. You know, there's a lot of people, a lot of members of the public, I think that you become an actor so that you can be on the cover of magazines and have thousands of people screaming your name out. But that's a bizarre ancillary activity. What we really do is go into rooms and pretend to be other people.
But there must be part of it in your head that goes, this is as good as it gets, as far as a claim is concerned, because you go to a huge multi-million-dollar movie premiere in London, the world's press are there, and everyone knows who you are, and they're all shouting your name.
I know, I got the tube here the next day. I just walked down the street today, no one knows who I am. So it's the perfect mix for me. It's very, very strange having thousands of people screaming your name out.
And like, can I just tell you,
Princess Diana's been reborn or something.
For the highlight of yesterday, which of the Warner executive speeches did you prefer the best?
Do you know what? It was very funny because one of the biggest head honchos in the world, who must surely public speak all the time.
Can I just say, thank you.
Shut up.
Thank you, London.
And then he said, can you hear me? Very clearly.
And everyone said,
yes.
No.
And then he did the fabulous gag of talking by waving his hands around the microphone near and near his mouth. And he got a huge round of laughter where I was. And then he carried on.
He employed everybody there. If there were more people like us there, we'd go, shut up and get on with the film.
There was, the bloke next to him is clearly, you know, the next down the chain. And he had the courage to say once, I have a microphone, actually. And he lifted the microphone somewhere around waist high, and then he dropped it again. And then we had 20 minutes of Marcel Marceau.
And then, as Mark was saying earlier, you get the three kids from Harry Potter, they come on, they're dismissed in five minutes.
That was brilliant. They literally came on. It was fantastic. You know, better than going, yeah, it's great. I hope you think it's great. Bye. Brilliant. That's how you do a speech. Now, although we were ashamed that you... We were shocked that you weren't up there.
Well, the whole cast was there. It was very funny because, as people will know when they see the film, it's pretty much all Ron and Hermione and Harry out on a road trip, kind of dodging evil. So there are the great and good of the British film industry. I exclude myself, obviously. And they're all milling around the party and they go, you were great. And I go, I had three lines. And they go, yeah, I didn't have any lines. I saw Tim Spall. He went, don't start getting bitter on me. I just waved my silver hand around.
Listen, Tim Spall is lucky to not strangle himself to death.
I don't know what that means. Is that an obscene...
No, it's a literary reference.
Oh, I see.
I just want to do the... Obviously, lots more with Jason in just a moment, but I just want to mention this from Peter Madigan. I was a native of Crawley, but listening in New York. The weekend before last time, I took the arduous four-hour bus journey from my home in New York City in Washington, D.C., to join the throng attending the Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert's Rally to Restore Sanity. You heard about that?
Oh, yeah.
Which is an extraordinary event. And did you hear and read about the posters?
Yeah, I've watched all of it from here, the satirical rally that dwarfed all the real rallies.
Yeah, so they had posters, things like saying, I disagree with what you're saying, but hey, on balance, you're not Hitler. Yeah. That, you know, those kind of things. I'm slightly irritated with the war. Those kind of things. Anyway, so he was listening to the podcast. And then he was at this rally, 200,000 liberal Americans, presumably, when he spotted this. Amongst those signs, he says... He was with this legion of rally goers. To my astonishment, I spotted a lone fellow holding aloft a hello to Jason Isaacs poster. So I'm smiling. This is here. This is Peter. I'm smiling goofishly on the right. We'll put this on the website. Okay, you have to see this. I'm smiling goofishly on the right. The sign craft is on the left. So at the rally for sanity for Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, one person, hello to Jason Isaacs.
I feel like I'm living out in real life being John Malkovich or something. There is a fantasy version of me that you've created.
I know, yes.
Out there.
Well, also
I liked it when you just said hello to me, like somebody who knows me.
Somebody sent me a link to there's a T-shirt company now, sells a T-shirt that says hello to Jason Isaacs. And it says the T-shirt to be seen in, sorry, in which to be seen.
And then Peter continued, after exchanging a few words about our mutual love of old Flappy Hands and his bickering partner in crime, I promised the good-natured American chap that I would email the photo to you both and assured him that you'd both get a mention on air as testament to the ever-growing cult of the good doctors. Love the show, Steve. From Peter. So that's an American listening to the programme.
It's
so
beyond rationale. What did he think? Why did he think someone would come across him and get it to you in England?
Yeah, keep going.
Have you finished with your social networking now?
I'm just attaching a photograph to this tweet of Jason in the studio, that's all.
You just took a photograph of Jason taking a picture of me. Oh, my. Why did you do... That's not... Have you done something with that?
Excluding, it's radio, it's not good, is it?
It's one of the worst photos of all time.
Is that...
It's been treated.
He has been treated. Jason has taken a photograph of me that makes me look... Yeah, even...
There's a moment in the Harry Potter film where, to disguise Harry, Hermione... Is it like a stinging spell?
It is a stinging spell.
It makes his face swell and distort and look hideous. And you look like that,
looks like. Why don't you put that up on the Wittertainment website?
It's like you in 3D,
It's called... I don't want to advertise products, but it's called Fat Booth, and you can take a photograph of anyone and make them five times the size. It's hilarious, of course. Fat people don't know.
We're being live streamed. You can go on the 5Live website and you can watch all the Five. And I can't imagine that there'd be anything else that anyone would want to do.
Since you just mentioned the 3D thing, or you mentioned the 3D thing. So the film that we saw last night was in 2D, right? Yeah. And I have to say, I let out a whoop, you know, when I heard that actually after the story about them retrofitting it, that they were going to do it in 2D. You and I had a conversation at one point in which I said, the retrofitting the 3D, what's the thing with that? And you did say, look, they won't do it unless it's really good. And I have to say, hats off, you turned out to be right, but I was so pleased because I was looking at it last night. It's designed in 2D.
I know, it's beautiful. It's shot that way. I had a long conversation with them about it. And they...
Did you?
You know, yeah. And they were asked to make it 3D, obviously, and they tried their very best. And I think it's a real tribute to Warner Brothers, who, let's face it, are a financial corporation. They look at profit and stuff. And the producers are film producers. They're in a business. And yet, all of them love these films so much. They kind of care about doing them right that they went down the road for a while. And then at some point, they went, we just can't make it good enough to match the quality of the stuff that people come to expect. And they stopped. And that must, you know, not about lose the money. They're going to make tons of money. But it must reduce the amount of money they could make. And I thought it was really, really impressive that they made that decision. They stuck by it.
Having said that, can I just talk about the film and it being part one? Because when it finishes...
It's annoying.
It is.
It's just annoying,
it is very annoying. And so that the reaction at the end of the movie, instead of that kind of sense of release, which you get most of you go, oh... And I don't know
about O, but you certainly get... I mean, I was frustrated.
Wow, and
yeah, but no, I got frustrated that I have to wait till July. It's true. But then they face this thorny dilemma. Do they compress everything? And, you know, there's a received wisdom in storytelling, particularly in screenwriting, that the end is the most important part of any film. If you have a good ending, then you have a film. You can extrapolate beginning and middle. You can't do that if you have a good beginning. A bad ending just ruins things. And they're not trying to end a 2.5-hour movie. They're trying to end a 10-year adventure in people's lives. It's a tough gig. And I think that they feel that responsibility keenly. And they've had a lot of complaints about the things they've left out of the books before, but had to. And I don't think it was a financial decision. Witness them deciding not to do 3D. They wanted to try and tell the full story as best they could. Listen, I sat next to a lovely kid called Joe last night. Not your Joe, someone else. And at some point, he loved the film. At some point, he went, oh. I said, what? He said, well, they meant to go back to Tonks' parents' house and they've gone straight to the Burrows. So you can't please everyone. They've packed in as much as they can. And this is a primer. It's a kind of the lull before the storm. What I thought about watching it, I thought it was amazingly brave that they take this franchise that the world loves to watch and they have the courage to tell a completely different story. It's essentially a very emotional story. There's some action set pieces, some funny stuff, but there's none of the familiar things. It's adult thing.
In the book, you get this kind of slow, dark, bleak stuff when the three kids are off intense mm-hmm. for a long period. And then the book takes off and it goes to that fantastic climax towards the end so that you don't get that. So what you have is a slow, dark,
It's interspersed with kind of high octane action stuff and some great set pieces at the Ministry and other places. But it's true that there's a lot of stuff where you really work out the relationships and build the depth of it. But then I've been in films, for instance, I was in Black Hawk Down, which is a much loved and very popular film. And people said about that, I wish it had been much longer and had time to get to know the characters because it's all action. Had they just done the big action sequences, you wouldn't have paid off 10 years investment from people who've really spent a lot of their adult life watching this.
Can I just put the contrary point of view? But I didn't feel, I know that you did, and I understand that I didn't feel a disappointment at the end. Firstly, because I think that actually there is a proper ending of AP7A, because without wishing, I mean, interesting.
Well, it's a cliffhanger, it's an ending.
No, it's a cliffhanger, but there is a tragic denouement before that. And in fact, what happened, as we sat down, Simon said to me, well, where are they going to break the book? And I said, well, it has to be, I don't want to say what the ending is, but I mean, I know everybody knows this, but after the Dumbledore and the unfortunate, I don't want to give it. But I said
be a secret, can it?
Oh, it's bizarre. Do you know the size of the confidentiality contract that you sign as a Potter actor is bigger than the book itself? And every time I sign it as Mickey Mouse or John Lennon, they go, too late, it's already on YouTube. But it's bizarre because they are the best-selling books in the world, and yet there is a real sense of mystery in the storytelling. And particularly in this last one, the people who've loved the book, you know, it certainly honours the spirit of it, but there's a lot of stuff in the book which is less visual. And the filmmakers, I think, are emboldened now by the success of the films. And they've made it a big visual spectacle as it comes to a close. And I think you'd be quite surprised by something.
It is a big visual spectacle, but actually...
The second one,
but what's interesting about the first one, firstly, I don't agree that it doesn't have an ending. I did think that ending, the tragic denouement ending worked, and then the cliffhanger.
Whatever that might be.
But I also thought that, actually, I mean, there are huge sections of it in which you look at it and you think, this looks like an art film. I mean, you know, very, very drained colours, very bleached colours. I mean, on some level...
It takes the time to tell the story in a way you don't expect films aimed at this audience to take the time to tell the story, scenes of nuance and subtlety.
It adds stuff in, Jason, right at the very beginning. Sorry, Mark.
Go for it.
They add that there's a sequence with Hermione and her parents, which is referred to in the book, but it's not. But they've added that in. I was thinking, blimey, if they're adding stuff in, we are going to be here a long time.
Sometimes you can make glancing reference to something in a book and you realise it's a visual sequence. I mean, I found that incredibly moving. I think we can give that away. It's right at the beginning. She decides that her parents are best off not remembering her, and she waves her wand and all of the pictures of her disappear. And you're about 30 seconds in and it's incredibly moving and you think, that feels very grown up.
The dance, of course, isn't in the book either, and that was a very, you know, it's a lovely sort of light moment. I mean, I was surprised.
You need to explain that there's a dance between Hermione and Harry.
And we're not giving anything away here because there's been a lot of press about this. There's a scene in it in which Hermione and Harry dance together, which you know, you can.
It's very surprised. I was completely surprised by it. I had no idea where it came from.
They're listening to a radio. And it's in the middle of all this. Everything's going from bad to worse to worse, and in the middle of it, there's this little moment. As there are all the way way through, there are these little moments of, you know, sort of the tenderness amidst actually what is, I mean, as you said yourself, I mean, of course the tone of it's dark. It's, you know, it's the reign of Lord Voldemort. It's not meant to be.
Listen, my kid, my Lily, my 8-year-old, often asks about war. What, you know, she sees the headlines in the newspaper and what's going on. And I think that kids who watch this film will have a very real sense of what it's like to live in a country where you're paranoid and if you look over your shoulder. That sense of dread and peril is very real. And although you're right, a lot of it, it's not a criticism, I love the fact that it goes very gentle and that you're often intense with people. It's also true that my wife spent maybe 20% of the film with her coat over her head, refusing to watch what was going on because she was terrified.
There are also references to things like Terry Gilliam's Brazil. I mean, all the stuff within the Ministry of Magic, which clearly in the sort of sub-Nazi lettering and the fact of the industrial corridors looking very, very sort of, you know, Gilliam-esque 1984. I mean, all that stuff, I thought.
Yeah, it's also worth saying, and I think this is entirely fair, that clearly there is no attempt to explain the backstory. By the time you get to the seventh film, you're kind of thinking, what is it? If someone just came and joined at this point, they would have no idea.
No, that's true. Well, I've just been holed up in a hotel with the rest of the actors for days and days doing 5 million interviews with people around the world. And at some point, somebody said to me, it's a few questions. Sometimes they say, is this okay for small children? And you think, well, I'm in the business of selling this film, but I have to be honest with you. I think small children shouldn't come and watch this film. But I also think that they ask, is it okay to come to this film if you've never seen any of the other films? I'm not sure there's anybody around in the universe that would choose to go and see Harry Potter 7 Part 1 without having seen the first six. If they do, they're stupid.
There you go. We'll add it to our code of conduct.
That would be good, though, if you had previously on Harry Potter. See the films.
Here's an email which has just come in. This is from Charlie, who says, I just thought you'd be interested in this. This is the thoughts of one of our film club members' reviews of Deathly Hallows, Ben Angus, who's 13 from the Boswell School in Chelmsford, because here we are, a bunch of middle-aged men discussing it. Mm-hmm. So here is the thought of Ben Angus, who's written this, okay? A couple of lines from this. He says, it's an absolutely fantastic film. It's hard to find a fault. The story is gripping right the way through. You are constantly trying to figure out the twists and turns, and the scary scenes really add to the excitement of the film. Be warned, though, they are perfectly placed to make you jump. The effects are absolutely jaw-dropping, especially a broomstick chase at the start of the film, which makes you forget to breathe because of how amazing it is, in capital letters. There are some slow moments. As for the majority of the film, Hermione, Ron and Harry are in hiding in a forest in the middle of nowhere. However, this just makes the action sequences even more exciting because of the contrast in pace.
I'm with Ben. I think he's one of the finest film reviewers I've ever encountered.
I have to tell you, my 9-year-old son said, I mean, loved it, said afterwards, we were talking about the 3D thing, and I was saying, it's so great that it's not in 3D. And he said, yeah, because if that scene when Nagini came out had been in 3D, I think I would have died. And I said, no, actually, it would have been less effective. You have to understand, stereoscopy doesn't work. But as far as he was concerned, if they'd turned it up more than that, it would have been too much.
No, my wife actually screamed out loud, which elicited a ripple of laughter in the entire bank of the cinema.
A listener called Mark Whittaker has just tweeted us a picture of the Hello to Jason Isaacs t-shirt. And he says, yay, they've mentioned us, the Wittertainment t-shirt. I think we should be on points, don't you?
I think we should be definitely on royalties, yeah, definitely.
Do you want to be on that, Jason?
I wish I'd been on a share of the wand in Lucius Malfoy's right hand. That's what I wish.
Daniel in Nottingham is in the middle of what he calls a Wittestential crisis. In regards to the much-discussed cinema code of conduct, it seems that there is only one rule in which we can all agree, and this is probably the right moment to be, you know, to say that it should be carved into the two marble tablets. This is, of course, the law that no one can, under any circumstances, talk during a film. However, with the release of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 in 2D only, yay, says Daniel, your devoted listeners have a problem. What should we do when Lucius Malfoy appears on the screen? And every inch of our being impels us to say hello to Jason Isaacs. What is the answer? If we are allowed to say hello to Mark's former classmate, is it not just a case of one rule for the Doctor's disciples and another for those as yet untouched by the great Commodian light? However, if we forbid ourselves from our natural tendency to greet Mr. Isaacs, what is to unite the listeners of your great show? Thanks, Daniel. I, for one, was rather looking forward to listening out for the whispered hellos when I go and see the film at my local multiplex. I was just wondering whether there is an adapted version, which is that you all wave. And you, I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Mal? What should people do? They don't want to speak out loud during a film.
When we first discussed this and you brought this up and you said, actually, I think what people should do is they should go like that. And I said, well, what that'll do is that'll create a little breeze. So rather than the way people say,
or a gale,
hello,
if you're there.
Gale, yes, exactly. Thank you. Boom. But you will just get this little, wherever you go, there'll be this waft of people waving at you.
I do all the kids that visited the set over the years, because I had kids visiting every single day over the 10 years.
You did? It was like you were running a creche.
I did. They were fantastic, the producers. It's true, lots of the actors, but I think Alan Rickman and I took the record. But anyway, all of them, I made them promise the condition of them coming is that whenever I came on screen, they had to cheer and not explain that to the other people in the audience.
Which I think is top. A text here says, Lucius Malfoy is the king of badass. That is all.
Oh, God love him.
Although, you have to say, I mean, people who've read the book will know that you're kind of scared.
No. You have been whooped.
Oh, I'm pathetic and cringing, slimming wreck. Actually, one of the lovely things for me is that all the other actors, these fabulous actors who, you know, do a turn every time, they basically do the same turn every time. And Lucius has been to prison in number six. He's come back a horrible, shambling wreck of a man. I don't like to think what happened to him in there, but it wasn't very tasty. And then I come and sit at the table. I think maybe Voldemort is going to give me a place back at his right-hand side. And instead, he takes my wand and he snaps it, which is really an act of castration, let's face it, in front of the other Death Eaters and my son and wife. And then I think he's going to kill me with his wand. And he can't even be asked. Can I say that? I have already. He can't be bothered killing me at the table. And from that moment on, the ground is very uncertain under my feet.
And that the scene early on in which that's happening, obviously the whole thing about who's got which wand turns out to be very, very important going on. But my assumption is that Rafe Fiennes is wearing only some of that makeup in real life and some of it's done digitally.
Yes, he has a nose when we shoot.
It's not just that he's wearing a
snaky nose.
No. He's got all the kind of broken veins and bad teeth and funny fingers, but he's got a nose and he's got funny coloured dots on his face. So he's a little bit more like a Damien Hirst painting.
And then they just digitally reconfigure it to make the snake nose afterwards.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I have to say that Rafe Fiennes is thoroughly charming in real life. When they say action, it reminded me oddly of my very first day on Potter 9 years ago, whatever it was, with Richard Harris, because also a very charming, fabulous anecdotalist, and you say action and he drilled you. There's just waiting an extra half a beat before he spoke and you think, is it me? What's he going to do? And I felt like he was about to literally drive that one through my eye.
Wow.
He felt capable of anything. He's a very scary dude.
Sally Coleman in Sheffield, and this is just touching on the point which you've addressed, but let's do it specifically. My son, aged nearly 8, is desperate to see the new Harry Potter. Is it suitable or too scary? No, I mean, she says, I know it's a 12A.
I think if they've seen number 6, it's not like there's new characters, new monsters or nightmare images. It's a sense of dread and real peril and a sense that the world is not a safe place to live in that I think is more disturbing than any actual imagery. I don't know what you think.
Well, I mean, the standard BBFC thing is that 12 certificate below 8... it is not a good idea. So, I mean, I think 8 is fine. As I said, my nine-year-old really, you know, got it. I mean, obviously, has read the book, and I think a massive amount of the audience will have read the book. But there is, it's not to do with individual images being shocking, because actually, in some ways, there are individual images that are more shocking in previous films. It's to do with just the mounting sense of despair.
Okay.
And I refer again to that thing about saying that bits of it look like an art film. After you've had sort of, you know, all these vistas in which skies are darkening, everything's shot in half light, there are scenes in which the whole screen will be black and just a shaft of light with characters down the far end of it. Actually, I think it's more that you require a certain amount of maturity to be able to invest in that.
It's like the lull before the storm. Things get darkest before they're light, and you really do feel that there's an inevitable collision coming. I mean, you get a sense of that truck coming at you, and there's no way to dodge it. And Harry and Ron and Hermione are in these last moments almost of their childhood, but it's too late for them. It's on their shoulders. I sounds like I'm a snake oil salesman, but no one needs to sell tickets to this film. I think the filmmakers are spectacularly brave that they continue, and particularly this one, to change the goalposts and go, this isn't like the other films. We're not going to give you any of the familiar elements. We're going to tell the story the way we think it ought to be told, at the speed we ought to tell it, we want to tell it, and we're not going to do it in 3D because we can't do it well enough, and we're going to drain the colours and we're going to make you jump if we
feel. What about the next one? Is that going to be in 3D?
I think they have enough time. I think that they think that if they go through the process painstakingly enough, and every frame by frame, they'll be able to deliver something that matches the
quality. There is going to be a 3D version of this. The idea is that it is going to happen, but it'll I mean, my presumption is that they'll release the 3D version of this just before releasing the final installment. I would still hope, on the basis, because obviously the two things were shot simultaneously. Yeah. I mean, the look is not going to be substantially different. I understand there'll be special effects set pieces. My hope is that they would do what they're doing now, which is put the film out as it was shot, and then if you want to see a 3D version, then fine.
I
go
have
ahead.
Faith in the three Davids, called the David Baron and David Hamill, the producers, and David Yates, who directed 5, 6, and what would be 7 and 8. That they care more. I mean, I'm embarrassed at how cheesy I keep sounding when I'm talking about this film, but it's a really anomalous experience as a storyteller. that there is as much love and care for the affection and the story in the people making it as there is in the people watching it. And they want to make sure that they're proud of it when it's all finished, because they'd hate to make a dud at the end.
Well, it is unprecedented to have spent that much money and to have gone public and said, we are doing this in 3D, and then to have said... There's a confidence that
they'll be able to make it good enough that they won't be embarrassed, and they care about that.
Many years ago, I went to see the Norman Conquest, and I went to see all three on the same day, Nottingham Playhouse, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one in the evening. Of course, it's the same story, but taking place in three different rooms. And part of me wanted to have, selfishly, I just thought, right, having seen 7A, I now want to see 7B, and I'd like to see it tomorrow.
I agree.
And that would have been great if they'd say, right, we've made two movies, and we're going to release them pretty much at the same time. So that, you know... But
I think that's financial suicide. It is, in the end, some kind of business. And also, I'll be absolutely straight with you, they're still making the second one. There's tons of stuff to do on it. It's a massive process. It was an epic film.
Yeah, and I mean, also...
There's a lot of stuff to do. They couldn't get both ready.
And there is precedence in Kill Bill 1 and 2, although my feeling with Kill Bill is actually what should have happened is they should have just stood over Quentin Tarantino with a big stick and said, no, you know what, that's one film. I mean, it's not like in Kill Bill there was a whole bunch of plot they had to get through. In case of this, there is a lot. And
I can't engage with a process whereby you're comparing Kill Bill 1 and 2 with the Harry Potter films.
No, Kill Bill 1 and 2 is, of course, a precedent for Harry Potter 7A and 7B. It's the idea of it's one movie. What are you going to do? You're either going to narrow it all down, or you're going to say it's going to be two films. The difference is...
Missed Kill Bill being one of the best-selling books in the world.
No, the difference is, without you being facetious just because we're friends doesn't mean you can necessarily get away with
Go
it.
Jason.
The difference is that in the case of Kill Bill, what they needed was somebody saying, no, Quentin, that's one film, okay?
Fair enough.
In the case of this, I think there is a perfectly strong argument for saying, you know what, it's not one film. It is, because actually, I do think the natural, I can't believe I'm fighting this corner, but the natural break is in the right place. And funnily enough, the question immediately was, once they've been released, both of them are out, will they reunite them as one film? And I think, actually, on the evidence of the first one, I think it is a film itself.
But I'm sure you'll be able to see both together. Many people will do a total weekend fest and get up in the morning and barely move from in front of a screen somewhere. And I think it'll be a laugh.
Because
there is that thing about watching these, you know, there's... Tom Felton plays my son, and he slightly stoops to talk to me now, and there he was, waist high, little angelic boy.
I think even though I did feel at the end it was a kind of, oh, is that it? Moment.
Right.
What I do want to do, all the way through today, I've been thinking, I really want to go and see it again.
Right.
Which, for a kid's entertainment film, you wouldn't want to do, because if you've seen a kid's entertainment film, that's it. You've seen it, you don't want to see it again until a couple of years later when it comes out and you can watch it with your kids.
Well, I saw it Sunday morning, but then I watched it again at the premiere yesterday, and I was thinking, it's a long film, I loved it, but do I want to watch it again? And there was so much more in it the second time, I've forgotten the huge bravura set-piece sequences all the way through it, because I remembered as people intense.
Logic would suggest, and in fact editorial direction has just given me instruction to finish this at 3. However, there are just a number of emails which I would wish to clear. Can you stay at 5?
I absolutely would.
He's not got anything to do now.
I've missed
finished
you the last 2 weeks.
I'm now going against
your Bolshevik tendencies.
I'm going against a clear instruction from the editor.
What, get me out?
That's fine. Okay, that's right. Right, I just want to
mention... enough of Jason Isaacs. Get him out of the studio now.
The last 2 weeks.
No, we've been away.
Being good fathers and being Bolsheviks on strike.
You can stay here for the top 10, because there must be stuff in the top 10 that you've seen that you can...
No, but he won't. You know what he's like, he'll never say anything.
Have you seen Let Me In?
Switch the microphones off and I'll tell you.
Have you seen Let Me In?
I have seen Let Me In. Right. And I was I was dreading it, and it's brilliant.
Right, you are excellent. So off the guest list.
Excellent, excellent, excellent.
I loved the original, and then I thought then I saw they cast that kid from The Road, who I thought was a magnificent actor.
It's not to do with the casting of the kids. It's not to do with the casting of the kids. It's to do with the doing it.
All right, I'm bluffing. I haven't seen it.
Fine.
Brendan Long, BA Honours, Popular Music, Media and Cultural Studies. With regards to the film...
What did that sound mean?
It was just, sorry, an exhalation. I thought Harry Potter, we're talking about 7A, was up there as one of the best. Very moody, atmospheric piece that gave little respite from the sense of impending doom. Wonderfully shot, and the acting was top draw. I thought in parts it drew heavily on Lord of the Rings, especially the two towers in the wearing of the corrupting Horcrux. The testing... yet all-conquering friendships of Harry, Ron, Hermione, and you could liken Ron's brief departure from the trio only to return and save Harry to Frodo's dismissal of Sam, only for him to return and save Frodo from Shelob. And I thought the dancing scene really worked, says Brendan Long.
Rock on, Brendan.
We have some movie reviews. Realise that we haven't done them, but we will get to them because we've got 2 weeks' worth and a box office top 10.
I should leave. I want to hear the reviews on the podcast. I missed it.
And I suspect that it's not worth you staying for the top 10 because
you
really, really won't say anything negative about anything.
You're rubbish.
So let's just finish
and you
in the top that. 10, there will be one or two that star people I could tell you the most libelous things about, but I'd never work again and probably be killed in my sleep.
Let's just finish with these then. Jill says, I'm in Orlando attending a conference. There's no internet access in my room. I can't listen to the show live, but my husband just rang me so I could listen to a bit of Jason Isaacs via the phone. So from sunny Orlando, hello, Jason Isaacs. Looking forward to hearing the podcast when I can find a Wi-Fi hotspot. Joe Hennigan. Having been a big fan of Jason since he stole the show in an episode of Boone, would he ever consider a mockumentary-type film of how Hello Jason Isaacs has taken over his life? In the same spirit of being John Malkovich, Jason would be followed by a camera crew capturing his daily acquaintance with constant Hello Jason Isaacs, extending from members of the public to co-stars and directors and studio bosses wearing the Hello Jason Isaacs t-shirt. I've just tweeted that we want two extra large copies, by the way.
Very good.
This is a treatment in progress, says
Joe. I'm frightened that it's all got out in the world and got so big that it has to end. It's going to explode in some terrible backlash. Whereas when it was just you saying hello to me every week, it felt very nice and intimate.
Jason, do you want us to stop?
Well, I don't like it being out. It's weirding me out slightly that there are people in other countries interrupting their wedding ceremonies for it. It's very nice.
That was a great best man speech.
I was on a red carpet a couple of years ago, and some woman said, "Did I tell you this? I can't remember. No. I've been on this so many times." There was a woman said to me, "Now, don't think I'm weird." And I went, "No," and she started unbuttoning her shirt, and she'd had me tattooed on her cleavage.
What?
And I went, "That's not weird. I'm so sorry. I have to leave now."
Okay, and you're worried about people saying hello to you in their wedding speeches. Frankly, you've passed into the land of the unwell.
A couple more. John and Liz in Portishead. Can you ask Jason about the Rickmansworths? These are Alan's pauses. We total them up to make sure that we've got our Rickmansworths in any movie in which he appears. Do the cast take bets on how long they are?
No, I don't know about his pauses, but I do know he has the most extraordinary jazz rhythms. It's like he's taken all the punctuation marks out and thrown them back in at odd places, and that's part of his genius as Snape. It's mesmerising being in a scene with him. He finishes and you go, oh, blimey, it's my turn to talk.
I was just looking back, clearly there's going to be a lot of him in part two, but there's not a lot of Snape.
Well, funnily enough, you went to see the film last night, and I don't make a major contribution, neither do any of the adults. That was 4 or 5 months of my life, what you saw last night. So Alan was probably around for a long time, too, for what you saw on there.
Final email. This is from Graham Donovan. Please see the generic email, below the gist of which is that I am growing a tash during November to help raise money and awareness of prostate cancer.
That's right. They're calling it Movember.
While I was preparing for my first tash shave and pondering what style said tash should take, I happened to be listening to your podcast and the email from the man who had the entire audience at the Phoenix say hello to him and his new wife was read out, and I automatically thought of Jason. After that, there was no doubt as to the style of tash to be worn. It would be the full handlebar as worn by Mr. Isaacs in Green Zone. Also, one or two more colourful characters in the Blue Oyster Bar, as seen in the Police Academy films. I'm in a team of four called the D.O. Mobros. I probably said that entirely wrong.
D.O. Mobros.
There you go. And we aim to raise £1,000, so if you could say hello to us, Graham, Dave, Thomas and Joe. They're styling themselves
Thomas and Joe, I am much honoured by that, as are all the Special Forces men serving all over the world with those very butch and yet at the same time extremely gay moustaches.
Right, Jason, say hello to Joe and Tim from URN.
Hello, Joe and Tim from URN.
I did a film show with them the other day. I mean, I was on there. They're from Nottingham, and I was up doing a thing.
I'm very conscious that I've missed you for 2 weeks. You've got 4,000 films to review and slag off. I'm going to go and listen to it on the way home.
What do we see you in next?
I think I'm in Abduction, the Taylor Lautner film, and some other
stuff. A bit of kickboxing.
Yeah, there'll be things. I'll come back and tell you about them when they're coming out. But right now, Harry Potter,
there'll
definitely
be things.
One is out.
You do fight him, though, don't you?
I do fight Taylor Lautner, and he doesn't come out too well, even though he is one of the world karate champions.
Are you
and
both
I'm just an
to
idiot.
The waist?
No, luckily enough. I thought I might be, though, so I worked out like a lunatic. And as soon as they said I wasn't going to be, I ate craft service like I was sponsored by the kilo.
Dave Morris's his three-word review of Harry Potter was, "Harry's got abs."
Which did look rather sharp, didn't he? I think that's all CGI.
Jason, appreciate you coming in. Of
Lovely
course.
To see you.
Thank you very much
Stop
indeed.
Going off for half term. Your kids can live without you. Bye.
All right. I'll tell them you said that.
Kermode and Mayo's film review. The UK cinema top 10.
5 Live. At 10, Birkenhair. Now, you said you didn't have any Birkenhair. So here's John in County Cork. If you cover Birkenhair in the box office countdown, and since Mark did not review it, here's my quick opinion. The problems with the turgid mess that Birkenhair is can be summed up by the end credits, where we get those annoying outtakes of each cast member corpsing up with laughter to show how much fun everyone had making this film.
There are corpsey outtakes. That's a shame.
The problem was they forgot the audience was meant to have fun too.
Okay.
Nathan McHardy, Master of Arts. Birkenhair, so boring, unfunny and embarrassing, I walked out after 45 minutes. The first film I've walked out of in 20 years of cinema going. Dominic says, Peg and Circus, funny and dark, New Landis. Birkenhair says, David in Edinburgh, over my dead body.
I mean, when Floyd and Boyd did it, I know Nigel was saying that he thought that actually it was a better film than that. The general opinion seems to be that it's not funny. The question is whether it's meant to be funny. I mean, John Landis himself, when he was on the programme when we weren't here, was saying that he was slightly alarmed by the publicity campaign, which made it look like a knockabout comedy, where in fact it's a film about, you know, about body snatchers. But I will have to go and see it, and I'll try and see it this week, but certainly mixed reports.
Another year at nine.
You see, I mean, I'm a Mike Leigh fan anyway. Leslie Manville came on the show, and when we were in Cannes, I did predict, albeit wrongly, that this was going to win the Palme d'Or. It's a story of a couple who are essentially happy, and their friends who are essentially unhappy, and it goes through four seasons, as the title suggests. And in that Mike Leigh way, it sort of looks at a number of... It looks at, you know, loneliness, isolation, community, and centrally the idea of people attempting to be good in circumstances in which that may not necessarily be the easiest thing to do. I mean, there is... I know that every time you talk about one talks about the Mike Leigh method, people say, oh, for heaven's sake, can we stop going on about this? You know, all he does, he gets people together, they improvise, and then that's how the film comes out. And it was interesting when Leslie Manville was on the show with us saying that, you know, essentially she comes up with the dialogue. You know, she knows that dialogue because she wrote it. I mean, I still find that process alchemical and hard to understand. But the end result of it is that what you get is a drama that seems terribly honest and truthful, and yet is also, you know, very funny. I mean, I think the thing that people forget about Mike Leigh is just how funny a lot of his work is. I really liked Another Year. I thought it was, you know, one of his best films in a long time. I preferred it to Secrets and Lies, which actually is the film that everybody seems to really sort of go for. But it reminded me most of all of the tone of High Hopes, which is one of my favourite Mike Leighs. I think he's really on form with it, and I suspect that it'll get nominated in the BAFTAs, which are coming up quite soon, because it's just a terrific Mike Leigh film. I don't know if it's a breakout film. I don't think it's going to attract any new fans, but I think it's a really solid piece of work.
Did you use the word alchemical?
Alchemical, yeah.
Achemical.
No, alchemical, like alchemy.
Oh, it's alchemy. Thank you very much. Just clearing that up.
Yeah, like Alchemy, which incidentally was the solo album by Richard Lloyd, who was in television with Tom Verlaine, and then they both went their separate ways. Tom Verlaine made Tom Verlaine, and Richard Lloyd made Alchemy.
Kinnan or possibly Kynan Webb on Let Me In. Oh, do you want to do Let Me In?
I do, yeah. Okay. But, why don't you do that first? Because I have a lot to say about Let Me In. And in fact, we've got a short clip which I'll play you, because we didn't get a chance to review this last week, and I do want to talk about this.
Well, why don't you introduce the clip then?
Okay, Let Me In, which is the English language remake of Let the Right One In, which was the Thomas Alfredson movie adapted from a novel, which is takes its title from a song by Morrissey. Story is of a young, outcast, bullied boy living in a block of housing, block of flats, who discovers an unlikely friendship with a young girl living nearby him, with whom he shares, on the one hand, an outsiderness, on the other hand, discovers that actually her life may be hiding strange and weird secrets of its own. Here's a very brief clip from the English language remake, Let Me In.
Are you a vampire? I need blood to live. But how old are you? Really? 12. But I've been 12 for a very long time.
The weird thing about this is, as you probably know, and because it's, you know, it's open now, and it's at number eight, which means it hasn't done spectacularly well, but the reviews for it were pretty impressive. I mean, it's got some 5-star reviews. Some critics have said better than the original. Many critics have said, you know, up there with the original. An awful lot of people said, if you haven't seen the original, then this, that and the other. Okay. My problem with Let Me In, and I saw it quite early on, and I've been mulling on this for quite a long time. I remember I said quite early enough, having seen it, the central thing is that the original is a film about children that happens to have vampires in it, and the remake manages to be a film about vampires that happens to have children in it. The central thing in the original film is that it's all about being an outcast. It's all about the anger and the rage of childhood, and it's about the way in which that anger and rage expresses itself. And although it has vampires in it, it is not a vampire movie. Once you look at the publicity for Let Me In, you realise that actually what they're attempting to do is to reconfigure it for the Twilight audience. It's got the, you know, the funny contact lensy eyes, everything about it, everything about the imagery for it is telling you that it's, you know, it's essentially it's in the vampire area rather than in the children area. And I am genuinely quite amazed and befuddled by how good the reviews of Let Me In have been. Because let's be quite clear about this. You don't need to remake Let the Right One In. If you make Let the Right One In and you make it as well as that, I mean, there are occasional false steps in Let the Right One In. I mean, the scene with the cats, for example, is a false step. But actually, the whole tone of the movie is so strange and off-kilter in a way which is so perfectly about what it's like to be an awkward kid, that the idea of transmogrifying that into some strangely homogenised, English language remake is infuriating from the outset. You know, there's been a lot of stuff recently that the guy who directed the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo has expressed his disdain for the fact that it's being remade in an American remake of David Fincher. The issue is clearly that people don't like to read subtitles, so let's see it again in the English language. Well, look, if you were up to understanding Let the Right One In, you are not going to have been put off by the subtitles. If you're the kind of person who was put off by the subtitles, you're not up to understanding Let the Right One In. The most annoying thing about Let Me In, and there are a million annoying things about it, like they didn't have special effects for it, let's do special effects. They things were ambiguous for it, let's make them not ambiguous. The thing that's really annoying about it is that whenever it works, it works because it's almost directly mimicking the original in a way which suggests that the people who made it, the Cloverfield guys, understood the original well enough to know why it is that they shouldn't have remade it in the first place. And I mean, I'm very clear about this. It's inexcusable and there's no reason for it. You don't need to do this, right? If you haven't seen Let the Right One In, let that after one, you know, get it on DVD. Get it on DVD now. And if at the end of that you feel the need to go off and see the English language remake, well, fine. That's your
business. Let me ask the question, though, that everyone else has then
brings up. If
you
haven't seen the original, Mark, do you think it would feel differently about it?
Well, you don't have to do it in that stupid patronising accent, because it's a legitimate question. Well, if one has not seen the original, would you go to this and think, do you know what, actually, that's quite a good film?
I'd sit there and think, what am I doing here? Why am I? You know, I'll tell you what it's like.
Now, if that is not available, okay, if this weekend.
But it is available.
Not
it
at
is
the cinema. Available. No, I'm queuing up at the cinema. I haven't seen the original. Mm-hmm. When I go and see this film, I'll be thinking, well, I'd like to see the original, but that was quite a good film. Will I not?
No, you'll sit there thinking, why am I here not watching the original? If you haven't seen
it. Because the original isn't on.
It's on DVD.
I'm in the cinema.
It was in the cinema, and now it's on
but
DVD.
But it's not now.
But go see something else.
But I want to see
okay,
this.
Okay, here's the thing, right?
You're watching it anyway.
Here's the thing. You're queuing up outside the Louvre, right? And somebody says, the Mona Lisa, says it in French, the Mona Lisa is not here. The Mona Lisa is being cleaned. But it's all right. We have a very good painter. He's coming. He's done a copy of it. Yes, it's not bad. No, and they can say.
By the way, excuse me. This is in English with a French accent.
Yeah.
You said in French. That's just...
Okay, the Mona Lisa, il est disparu. Disparu. On y va. On y va. Mais ici, il est en image replicateur.
Postcard.
No, not even a postcard.
Card de poste.
It's like, yeah, I'm sorry, we took away the Da Vinci, but Mr. DiCaprio or somebody has done a copy of it, and would you like to look at that? Because I tell you what, if you haven't seen the Mona Lisa, the copy's pretty good in French.
Mike says, I'm intrigued by Let Me In, since, as every right-thinking person knows, Let the Right One In was a load of portentous, slow-moving tosh that makes vague allusions to sexuality or abuse without ever saying anything about them, and relies on characters being stupid or incompetent to move the plot along. So does the remake function as enjoyable schlock, or does the whole film still collapse as soon as you ask, why doesn't anyone call the police?
Well, I think that if you think that about the original, and obviously, other opinions are available, I don't think that the remake is going to solve any of those problems.
OK. Jack says, went to see Let Me In the other day, and being a huge fan of the original, didn't have high hopes. However, I tried my best to put the original out of my head and enjoy it. I soon found out that this would be an impossible task, as Let Me In is not so much a remake, but more like a direct translation of the original work, of the original that didn't work.
Whenever any of
the characters were on screen, I couldn't help but remember how much better the exact same scenes were in the original.
Exactly.
Chloe Moretz is a brilliant young actress, but seemed out of place as the child vampire, and I didn't believe in the central relationship at all.
No.
Kieran Webb, Let Me In is good, but Let the Right One In is a classic. While the two child actors are very good, Chloe Moretz just doesn't have the haunting quality of the original's Lena Leanderson. Despite this, I wouldn't dissuade anyone from seeing Let Me In, as it counts as a vote for intelligent horror. Remember, Saw 3D has done much better business than the previous film, which will no doubt be interpreted by Hollywood as just add 3D to any torture horror and it'll be a hit. Mm. So that's my point, that Kieran, intelligently it seems, is saying, I'm not dissuading anyone from seeing it because it is a vote for intelligent horror.
But it isn't. I mean, it's like okay, if you have to choose between Saw 3D and Let Me In, then yes, Let Me In is more intelligent. But that's like saying, I mean, would you rather hit yourself on the head with a hammer or with a newspaper? Neither of them are a particularly good idea, but the newspaper will probably hurt less. And meanwhile, Let the Right One In is on DVD. I mean, stop me if I've said this before.
Okay, right. You've said it before. Number seven.
The child actors you've are great. Said it before. It's not their fault.
Social Network at 7.
I like.
Red is at 6.
Which, you know, funnily enough, got some quite stinky reviews, but Red's sort of all over the place. But I kind of enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to. Sorry.
What?
No, I was going to say, you're moving on.
Yes.
Okay.
Paranormal Activity 2 as
Paranormal Activity Part 2.
James Brown says, as a regular
James
podcast
Brown.
Listener, I've recently got into the habit of listening to the show on my weekly run home from work. What with the lights drawing in, I listened to the most recent podcast on the last opportunity I'd have to run through London's parks before the clocks went back and darkness would accompany my run home. So it was that I came to be running through Highgate Woods in the gloom during your review of Paranormal Activity 2. I've not seen this sequel, but I doubt anything in it is as frightening as someone, in this case, Dr. Kermode, unexpectedly shouting,
"Boo!"
at terrific volume in your ear in near dark woods. Perhaps to follow on from your question of a few weeks back about how the podcast can have improved or even saved lives, the reverse thread would be how many people you've nearly brought an untimely end to.
To whom you have nearly brought an untimely end.
Can I just say, correcting pronunciation and grammar is about the most irritating habit you have, and there are many.
There are many, and that is the most irritating of them.
Saw 3D.
Paranormal Activity 2.
Saw 3D is at 4. I've done that. Despicable Me's at 3.
Well,
Jackass 3D.
No, hang on. You're dashing on. We haven't done it. Saw 3D. Okay, fine. Went to see it. It was rubbish. And it wouldn't have made any difference whether it was 3D or 2D. The Saw franchise is so dead in the water, it's unbelievable. I mean, it is like just watching somebody drive. Birkenhead, grave robbing, kicking corpses around. Yeah, Saw 3D, that would be that. As far as Despicable Me is concerned, as we've said before, the crucial fact here is that more people saw Despicable Me in 2D than they did in 3D. And when you look back on the history of this period, I mean, I speak as somebody who, incidentally, you know, understands that Martin Scorsese right now, as we speak, is making a 3D movie, and Werner Herzog has made Werner Herzog Goes to a Cave, or Cave of Dreams, whatever it's actually called. You know, so people are experimenting, people are pushing the boundary. James Cameron's now signed on for Avatar 2 and 3, and the extended version is now out on Blu-ray, because I'm glad about that, because I thought the one
keep
problem
it brief, brother.
It's not very funny and it's not very clever, but it's better in 2D. Jackass.
Jackass 3D at 2.
Well, the joke. Can we hear the very beginning of the Jackass trailer? Or we've not got time?
We can do what we want.
Okay,
we're here till 4.
Okay, the very beginning of the Jackass trailer. Here we go.
This isn't the best idea ever.
When Time Magazine called 3D the future of movies.
Yeah! Three, two, one.
We doubt this is what they had in mind.
Okay, but it does allow me to say, but on the other hand, that's actually the kind of, that's what 3D deserves. Now, the thing with the Jackass 3D thing is odd, right? Because on the one hand, the 3D isn't very 3D. I mean, there's a lot of 3D effects at the beginning, but the rest of it is actually not very 3D. It wouldn't make very much difference watching it in 2D. I had a strange experience with Jackass, which is pretty much the same experience I had watching the first Jackass, is that there's some jokes at the beginning of it, like the first 20 minutes, which is basically people hitting each other, which are funny slapstick jokes. There's a joke when they've got a great big polystyrene hand that's attached to a springy crane, right? And people are walking through the office and this hand goes bang and it hits them and one of them
is carrying... I've seen that in the trailer.
Okay, did you laugh?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, exactly, fine. So the first maybe 15, 20 minutes of it is just those guys hurting themselves.
Give me five.
Yeah, five, bang, and then doing something else and then hurting themselves and then doing the... Then, however, it then suffers from exactly the same thing which always hobbled Jackass, which is that it very quickly descends into bodily excretions, at which point I just lose, on the one hand, interest, and on the other, I mean, I don't understand the obsessive, infantile thing about excretions in all their many... I mean, there's an awful lot of scenes in Jackass 3D of people being sick. And I don't know about you, but, you know, not for me. So it's a weird thing that there's 20 minutes of really funny people getting banged in the face humour, which is kind of, you know, good old-fashioned slapstick. Somebody walks along, bang, that happens. And then there's about 40, 50 minutes of just, in an odd way, sort of repellent toilet humour.
It was your suggestion, Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet, was your suggestion of a movie a couple of weeks ago.
Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet and is sick in 3D.
That's what it is.
But there is 20 minutes of Mr. Poopy smacks somebody in the hand with a huge polystyrene, in the face with a huge polystyrene hand and spills soup all over them, which I have to, for the first 20 minutes, I laughed. I would be lying to say I didn't laugh. And then after that, it was just like, oh, we're back in the toilet.
Simon in Exeter, I have a confession. I had a bad week last week. I needed some laughter to lighten my mood, so begrudgingly I went and saw Jackass 3D, and making no bones about it, I loved it. It made the badness go away, and I just cracked up seeing Johnny Knoxville dance in an empty bullpen on roller skates, waiting for the inevitable oncoming pain when the bulls were released. Joviality aside, I can see the good doctor liking this film as it embraces the fact that 3D is a gimmick.
Yes, it does. I mean, it treats 3D exactly as it should do. There is, you know, that is what it is for, but nothing in the film is as funny as the first 15, 20 minutes of people just getting smacked in the face.
The UK's number one is Due Date.
Which, you know, Hangover Part 2. Basically, Robert Downey Jr. has got to get himself back to his wife, who is due to have a baby, but as he gets on the plane, he meets up with this guy who's disreputable, and they both get thrown off the plane, so therefore they both have to make their way back across country together, so it's the plane, trains and automobiles thing. And as... In a way, you can kind of tell from the beginning how this is going to pan out. There are going to be individual moments of humour in it, which are largely down to Robert Downey Jr. has had the most incredible career resurrection. 5 years ago, you'd said that he's actually going to be a mainstream box office pull, and he was going to be able to do comedy movies, and he wasn't going to be the most annoying thing on earth, and was going to be better known for his on-screen appearance than for his off-screen appearances. You'd never have believed it. But in fact, he is the best thing about this. The rest of it is pretty ropey. I mean, it is pretty much... all the stuff that you know about, you've seen before. It has, you know, it has all the worst excesses of the Hangover, of finding certain elements of of male bad behavior funnier than they actually are. But I confess that there were things in Robert Downey Jr.'s performance that made me chuckle, made me chortle, and it wasn't totally painful. I certainly had a far less bad time with it than I did with The Hangover.
Now, if you're just joined us and you're wondering, are we still doing the box office top 10? That's because earlier we were joined by Colin Farrell, who was talking about London Boulevard, and Jason Isaacs came in, talk a bit about Harry Potter as well. That'll all be available on Listen Again in case you missed it. Also, the podcast, which will be available very shortly. Lots of people say, where's the podcast from last week? Obviously, there wasn't a podcast last week because there wasn't a program last week because of the industrial action thing. The code of conduct, our charter for film behaviour, which we were going to do today, we're postponing just because we had Farrell and Jason Isaacs to discuss stuff with. Still vast numbers of emails and suggestions coming in. Sam Fidian's concern, he says it's the sort of person that really needs to take note of your collected wisdom will probably not bother reading past the first couple of points. They're most likely too busy texting their friends and updating their Facebook profile as they practice opening their bag of chips. So could there be a pithy one-liner at the top which basically says,
"Oi, you, stop!
Thou shalt not be a rude and selfish idiot," is Sam's suggestion.
You know what I think we should do? I think we should do the code of conduct in Swedish and then remake it with English.
Jack Swain in London, I went to see Red on Wednesday. at the excellent Coronet Cinema in Notting Hill. And my enjoyment of the film was almost ruined by the lady sitting behind me. Every time something funny or even mildly amusing happened, she would burst into high-pitched giggles, then, snorting through her own laughter, repeat the line from the film that had caused her so much mirth, before tailing off into a long sigh.
Oh, that is very poor.
As though nostalgic about the line that she'd heard just 2 seconds ago. I'm really a very laid-back person, but I was so incensed by this, I was tempted to turn around and go all Nicolas Cage from Wicker Man on her. Instead, I mentally scanned the Wittertainment Code of Conduct. I couldn't pinpoint a suitable indictment, so can I throw in not repeating lines from a film like an idiot to be included?
Yes, but although that's kind of specific in the same way as not waving around lightsabers, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is a very
specific thing.
Here comes review number one.
So Skyline, if you've been reading the papers, you may have, some papers don't have reviews of Skyline. Certainly, some magazines don't, because the press screenings of it were, shall we say, erratic. It was not widely screened. There were a couple of screenings, but they were. And so this morning, which was the film actually opened this morning, people went along to the cinema to see it there. And it was one of those really weird cases in which you couldn't figure out whether they didn't want you to see it or they just hadn't got round to you seeing or what the story. Anyway, so the story is you've seen these big posters all over the place, and it's a side of buses poster anyway, and the trailer's been played quite a lot, and the trailer makes it look like kind of Independence Day meets the Matrix in a sort of post War of the World, post Cloverfield kind of way, and it kind of is that. The story about it is that it's directed by the brothers Strauss, who are effectively special effects guys.
Is that the Strauss brothers?
No, they're referred to as the brothers Strauss.
Why?
Well, I suppose it's like the Brothers Grimm, isn't it? It's like, I mean, it's an affectation, but
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, but I don't know. If they want to be the Brothers Strauss, there's another filmmaking couple who refer to themselves as the Brothers something.
Brothers Wachowski.
Well, there's the Dark Brothers, of course, but that's a whole different kettle of fish.
What about the Bellamy Brothers? Would they count?
The Bellamy Brothers.
The Bellamy Brothers.
Bellamy. Bellamy, yes.
Does that make them sound better?
To let your love fly. Brothers Bellamy. No, anyway, so the Brothers Strauss.
The Brothers Doobie.
Are you going to pursue this, or am I going to actually be able to get say anything about this? They have a special effects background. They've worked on things like Avatar and 2012, Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and of course they directed AVP, Alien versus Predator, Requiem, and so unsurprisingly, when you look at the movie, and it's Gillis and Woodruff have done the special effects, they've done creature creations. When you look at the movie, you do see all those things in it. I mean, the best way of understanding it is that it's a post District 9, post Cloverfield, small drama with big special effects, in which essentially there's a couple of people in a very ritzy apartment, and then aliens invade the world and big special effects stuff happens, but the group of characters that we're focusing on essentially are being all shot with handheld cameras. It's red cameras that they're using to do it. So you have, on the one hand, small scale human drama, on the other hand, great big monstrous special effects. Here's a clip.
What happened? They took Walt.
What do you think of Walt? What are you talking about?
This one was different. It came in the building and it just snatched him.
Then we should just go.
Hold on a sec. Am I the only one who saw those photos? That's all happening right outside, right now. They're everywhere.
No, they're not everywhere. They're not over the water.
That's right. Yeah, well, it didn't take them very long to find you on the roof.
We can drive there in 2 minutes.
You have no idea what they're capable of.
Elaine, I know you're scared, okay? We're all scared. But I'm not burying my head in the sand and hoping this goes away.
I'm not saying that.
Hey, look, just take it easy, man. There's nothing easy about this, Jared. They're in the building!
The Brothers Sutherland and Quiver.
That'd be Quiver and the Brothers Sutherland.
Okay, yeah, that's better. Okay. Much better.
So here's what's interesting about the film. In terms of its financing, the story is that the directors, the brothers Strauss, effectively independently financed it, totally outside of the studio system, and then it was then picked up and now has a proper studio distribution. The budget is anything between a reported 10 and 15 million, which for a great big special effects science fiction movie is really nothing at all. And you have to say that it gives you loads and loads of monsters for that money. I mean, essentially, once the alien invasion has started, there is a huge amount of full-on Ghibli effect. Now, originality is not its strongest suit, in that, there are all the way through echoes and riffs and rip-offs of a bunch of other movies that you've seen. It's also true that whilst it is a post-Cloverfield film, that same idea, you know, Cloverfield handheld camera. You remember the whole thing with Cloverfield was like Blair Witch Project meets the War of the Worlds. Mm-hmm. You saw Cloverfield, didn't you?
Yep.
You kind of quite liked it?
Yep.
Right, okay. Whilst it is a post-Cloverfield thing, it is also, more significantly, a pre-Monsters film. There's this film coming up called Monsters, which is a very strange hybrid, in which it's essentially a road movie character piece with these two central characters, but it happens to have these great, big, huge extraterrestrial beasts in it. And what's happened is we've reached a very interesting tipping point technologically. In the past, if you had made a cheapy monster movie, what you end up with is a guy in a rubber mask with fish ears, or you'd get some, you know, quite poor digital special effects. What's happened now is that the people who understand visual effects have their craft has leapt forward so dramatically that it is now possible for people to make fairly low budget movies with low budget independently spirited ideas, but with great big ripping special effects. Now, it's not that when you see Skyline, the special effects are indistinguishable from the special effects of really, really mega budget stuff, like, for example, Independence Day. I mean, there are certain moments in which, particularly in the fireball explosions, in which actually the superimposition doesn't quite work in the way that it should do, and you can't. I saw it on quite a big screen, so you can see the edges of it. But generally, you have to say, you know what, for the full-on monster quality, the monsters are there, and generally they're doing all right. Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just a bit on the monster.
Yeah.
Right? So say one of the monsters is in the room now,
yeah,
and I go up to it. What happens to me? What kind of monstrous thing is it going to do?
There are different formats of it. There's a huge big spaceship, which looks like the spaceship out of District 9, which comes down, hangs over all the... Then all these sort of flying-y monsters come out of it that look like the octopus monsters from The Matrix,
right,
and also look a little bit like the tripod arms from Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds. They come up, they shine a light at you, and you are sucked into them in a kind of actually in a kind of post-Quatermass sort of way. So I mean, every all the way through you're
so
watching,
I get
it
beamed up into the monster,
you get sucked into, you
and
get sucked
do I, into do the I get, have a chat and come back or what?
Well, that would be giving away what happens at the very
no but what happens to me,
you disappear, you go, you get sucked up into the monster, and
what
then
does he do with me then?
He sucks you up into
then
him.
What happens to me?
Well, you don't know what happens to him until later on in the film.
Do I get munched up?
Yes, you get eaten by the monsters,
okay,
right?
And
meanwhile, the monsters sort of put these long tentacly arms around, and so actually there are certain scenes in it which look like, directly like they're taking scenes from War of the Worlds. The whole film is quite a confusing experience, because on the one hand it has an independent sensibility with some ragged edges and some characters that you wouldn't see in a mainstream film. I mean, one of them is a rap star or a rock star of some description. Then there's a young couple who are sort of working out the problems. So you have that going on. On the other hand, you have great big monsters that if you'd seen them in a movie that was $100 million would just look like it was simply lifted from other movies, but it's not. The fact is it's done at $15 million. But the reason I say it's a pre-Monsters monster movie is that actually there's this other film coming, the director of which was on the show when we were off, in which what he's managed to do is to make essentially an art road movie that happens to have great big monsters in it. And I think the significance therefore of Skyline is it's a flawed film, it's a majorly flawed film in many ways, but it's not without interest, it's not without some sequences that are quite good, special effects, inventive stuff. Every single frame in it looks like it reminds you of another film, and in the end, as a whole, I think you'd have to say it's not wholly satisfactory, but nor is it wholly unsatisfactory. And I'm surprised it didn't get more press shown than it did, because frankly I would have thought that the people would have had some quite interesting and nice things to say about it. And perhaps the most significant thing about it is that it exists at a cusp. It exists at the moment when it has become possible for people like the people who are currently making Iron Sky, this strange European science fiction parody film. In 1945, Nazis went to the moon. In 2012, they're coming back, right? And it's guys sitting at home with their computers making special effects that 10 years ago you couldn't have dreamed of people making effectively independently. So what you have is an independently spirited oddball, actually all over the place, but a kind of diverting, interesting monster movie that will probably have its primary audience in the end on video, where on DVD, where the special effects will look perfectly fine. And it's a strange, odd mix of a movie, but it has moments of interest in it, and it isn't boring for it falls apart in the end, but that's kind of unsurprising. And it's made for $15 million, which is really quite extraordinary. And when you compare it to, for example, AVP R2 Requiem, it's just way, way better than that. It demonstrates that these guys have in them the idea that if you give them a bit of independent space, they'll go and do something that's more interesting than the stuff they've done before.
Is it the Brothers Key or Quay?
Brothers Key.
Brothers Key.
Yes, they are the Brothers Key. That's it. Fine. That is exactly who I was thinking of. Did that come to you, or did it come through your headphones?
I just know these
Remind
things.
Me, Simon, Sometimes of some I of the Brothers voices. Key's most famous films.
Well, there was I Left My Granny in the Cupboard, that one. And there's Where's Your Toolbox, Mr. Johnson?
Did you see that one?
I didn't, no. Was that in 3D? Really
yeah, because we
I thought that was a song by
The Brothers Doobie.
The Brothers Doobie.
Where's your toolbox, Mr. Johnson? Where's me Lilo?
I think... Yeah, you see, I think Where's Your Toolbox, Mr. Johnson was better than Street of Crocodiles.
Was it?
By a long,
was
long
it? Okay,
way.
Okay, fine.
And actually, and the Brothers Doobie are now doing the soundtrack, apparently,
yeah.
for Mr. Poopy Goes to the Toilet, which is going to be in a double okay. bill yeah. with... Where's your toolbox, Mr. Johnson? Yeah. What's the next film?
Yeah. Well, we'll do We Are Who We Are next,
shall we?
Cannibals.
What? We Are Cannibals. Toto Coelho, I think that was.
No, that's I Eat Cannibals.
Oh, yes. Very good. Listener Peter Gedge writes, I've just found a cinema in dire need of a projectionist. It is just downhill from the Ma Inn Hot Springs Hotel, 200 metres below sea level in Jordan. It seats around 20 in the open air, popcorn available from the converted 2CV at the rear. Although you'll have to add another cinema goer's annoyance to the list, the sound of thigh slapping due to the swarm of flies, not locusts, that are currently investigating my flesh. Onwards and upwards, he says, as everything is from the Dead Sea.
Very good.
And Robert Milton Keynes... This, again, just to repeat, we haven't done the code of conduct because that is now going to come out next week because it's been a very busy show. Rephones in the cinema to combat the ignoramus or ignorami who use their phones and therefore illuminate the cinema. I now carry a torch, says Robert, and where possible, go to their seat and shine it in their eyes and tell them that's what they've just done to me. I've already been disturbed. Now they have too. Now, I think that's a little bit extreme. And we're not necessarily endorsing that because you did that, you know. I mean, if I did that in my local cinema, I'd be interrupting a drug deal.
Yes, exactly.
You're shining that light. What? Okay, sorry, I did that. You know, so you have to be very careful. I'm just telling you that's what Robert is up to. So what's next?
Okay,
we are what we are.
We are what we are. I keep saying we are who we are because it's a translation from Somos Loque A. As we are what we are, which is. Best described, if you see it on the poster, it says, does for cannibals what Let the Right One In did for vampires, which isn't actually what it does at all. It's a very strange, gore-inflected art movie that begins with a guy dying in a street. We then find his family bereft, but... Also, now having to move on generationally, and they have a dark ritualistic secret, which is at the heart of their family, which turns out to be that they are a cannibal family for reasons which are, depending on how much you want to read into the backstory of the film, the reasons are either completely unexplained or are all there if you're searching for the clues. Essentially, it's this strange, weirdly twisted, incestuous family who obviously owe a debt to the family from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in which all the different sides of the characters in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre essentially represent different facets of the legend of Ed Gein. So it's the idea of the urban...
What's that about, then?
Well, you know Ed Gein, the Wisconsin ghoul.
No.
Okay, Ed Gein, the Wisconsin ghoul, who was a famous criminal, he was a grave robber and necrophile, who was the inspiration for Robert Bloch's story Psycho, that was then obviously the basis of the Hitchcock Psycho. But his character reoccurs throughout horror cinema, most significantly, I think, after that in Deranged, obviously, but in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So what you're talking about is like this weird, twisted urban family, incestuous urban family, with this dark cannibalistic secret, who then... have to move on a generation. Somebody else has then become the head of the family, and they then have to go out and find food for themselves. And the whole tone of the movie is this really sort of strange and often very, very upsetting juxtaposition between, on the one hand, something that would vaguely approach social realism, real characters in real situations. On the other hand, has this horrible dark art, which is clearly not supernatural, incidentally, which is why the whole thing about does for cannibals what Let the Right One In does for vampires is often... The in fact, much better touchstones in understanding the film would be, for example, I mean, obviously Martin, the George Romero film, which is about, is he a vampire, isn't he a vampire? No, actually what he is somebody who believes he's a vampire and is delusional in his vampirism. Or that Spanish film, The Hours of the Day, which is a serial killer movie, which in many ways sort of pre-echoes this in terms of its languid tone and its very strange shift between, on the one hand, very boring realism, and on the other hand, these sort of scenes of extreme aberration. I think you'd have to say that, you have to warn people in advance that the tone of the film is not entirely unified. It's very, very slow. Very slow. Very, very, very slow. Now, that clearly...
How slow,
it's
though?
Slow. It's we're going to track through this market for a
long time. This is Gregorian chant.
Well, yes. Actually, funnily enough, the pacing of it is not unlike the pacing of Gregorian chant. I mean, obviously done deliberately, which means that the build-up is very, very slow, which means that you get to meet the characters in a way which is an awful... And there are occasions where, at the beginning, where I have to say patience is required for that, building towards a sort of a finale which is deranged and obviously hints towards much more explicit gore cinema, but does so in a way that will I think, genuinely... alarm and upset somebody. So it's pitched oddly between the grindhouse aesthetic and the art house market, which is an area which I'm quite interested in. And at its best, as I said, it owes a debt to films like Hours of the Day, because it has that strange off-kilter quality that you're watching real people, but they're real people tied up in some horrible, guilty, awful secret that has somehow turned them from people into monsters, and their monstrousness is just on the edge of human rationality. I mean, it is a tough film. It is a tough film. It is a quite extraordinary in some respects. There are certain scenes in it that are quite breathtaking. There are other things in which you think, okay, this hasn't quite followed itself through. I don't think it's the masterpiece that some people have said, but I think it is, without wishing to give this away, it is clearly the film of the week, because there are things in it that make you think, well, there's an aesthetic sense there. There's some, you know, somebody has really thought hard about how to do this. I mean, I wonder whether the people who are ready for the gore will be ready for the langueurs, and the people who are ready for the art will be ready for the gore. But if you can, you know, if you can go in with an open mind and stick with it through the opening sequences, which some of which are, I think, you know, although I said the same thing about Hours of the Day, and I did stick with that, and I would happily watch it again. So it is the film of the
week. Are there more blunt instruments than in your average Gregorian chant?
There's lots of clocks. There's a massive amount of clocks, because one of the things that the film is about the way in which the family, you know, are obsessively devoted to ritual, and ritual of timekeeping, ritual of, you know, having to continue this awful cannibalistic ritual, which it seems is somehow based in some hideous, guilty secret, which may be completely natural or may be something else.
Can I ask you for an alternative? I realise it was still 4.5 minutes to go, so we're a little bit early on this. But for those who have absolutely no intention at all of seeing a gore-inflected film with blunt instruments, clocks and cannibalism, what would their movie
two things to go. You Again, which is, I think, we were told at the beginning of the screening that it's You Certificate, which is this kind of family-friendly touchstone romp in which Jamie Lee Curtis and Sigourney Weaver are the older female characters. What happens is that their respective daughters discover... At school, one of them was bullied. Then she grows up to be a successful businesswoman. Then later on, she discovers that her brother is marrying the girl who bullied her at school and has now reinvented herself as this kind of honest do-gooder. She thinks, oh, I can't forgive her for all the terrible things she did to me at school, and I want an apology. Then it turns, the mother says, you know, hey, you've got to let bygones be bygones and, you know, put all these things behind you. Then, of course, it turns out that when the mother and the aunt, who actually functions in loco parentis, meet each other, that they have an equal and opposite relationship. So it's about the idea that people you were at school with who are horrible to you, you meet them later on in life, are they still the same people that were horrible to you? Do all those broiling resentments still, you know, still fester away on the surface, or actually should we? That's on one level what it's about. On the other level, it's a completely sort of saccharine You Certificate, bouncy, frothy comedy with fairly broken... Now, here's the odd thing about You Again. Again, some of the reviews have been very, very poor. I enjoyed You Again more than I thought I was going to, partly because I think that Jamie Lee Curtis and Sigourney Weaver are funny in it, partly because there is an odd sort of dark comedy in that whole idea of unsorted out schoolyard issues. But the problem is, it's a film that pulls in three different directions. On the one hand, it's tending towards that kind of, you know, Easy A, Mean Girls, you know, depiction of school as being really horrible, really torturous, really the place where everything nasty and foul happens. On the other hand, it wants to be a frothy, family-friendly comedy with some broad jokes that in the end will end up in a group hug and everybody sorting themselves out in a cake fight. And obviously, from my point of view, I would rather it be the former than the latter. And all the way through, it can't make up its mind which of those two it wants to be. But that said, for a completely innocuous, frothy, you know, bubbly comedy with some people that you quite, you know, and you quite like from other movies, and accepting that actually, all in all, it's a confection of no substance whatsoever, there is a hint of a movie in there that is better than the one that you're watching. And I also confess, I laughed quite a few times. So I was not down on it in the way that I think some people be. The other
that
thing
might be on the poster. I laughed quite a few times.
I laughed quite a few times and was not entirely down on it. Mark Herman, Radio 5.
People have been.
The other thing I should mention is my afternoons with Marguerite, which is Gerard Depardieu's new movie, which is based on a novel by Marie-Sabine Roger. The story is, he is a kind of wastrel figure who inexplicably is having a relationship with a very, very glamorous young woman who loves him to pieces. I mean, Gerard Depardieu is... You know, Jason had that function on his phone just now, which was that you put somebody in and you do something to it and it makes them look larger than they are.
Fat booth, I think he called it. Yeah, make someone look fat and hideous.
Gerard Depardieu played Obelix in the Asterix and Obelix thing. I don't think he was wearing a prosthetic at that point. So, despite the fact that he is a curmudgeon of quite staggering size and difficult, he has this incredibly glamorous girlfriend who loves him, but the main thing is that what happens is he starts meeting in the park in the afternoons with an old woman who is just about to be put into a home by her family, and he discovers some form of love in a kind of Harold and Maude sort of way, which is that, you know, falling in love with somebody is to do with falling in love with ideas. He's essentially not very literate. She's somebody who reads books. She gives him a dictionary. He forges a relationship with her, which is entirely based on a kind of love of words and concepts and ideas. The whole thing is a total meringue of a film, and it has so many completely ludicrous leaps that it asks you to make, that you would believe this guy's situation, that you believe this relationship, the way in which he's working, not the relationship between a younger man and an older woman, but the circumstance in which he finds himself. It is a total meringue and a pudding, and Gerard Depardieu is not just eating the scenery, but he's just chewing the scenery up and swallowing it, and he appears to have eaten the sofa and everything else.
So if you like gore, the movie of the week is...
Well, it is We Are What We Are.
And if we don't like gore, it is...
We Are What We Are.
I don't want to see that, though.
OK.
So what should I see?
Well, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying it, but you know what? You Again is not as bad as it could have been.
I don't know who's on next week, but we will be revealing the Code of Conduct in all its glory. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Well, that was a full programme, don't you think?
Yeah, also, I forgot to say, in the end, when you were saying Film of the Week, Skyline went completely out of my head. So if you don't want gore, the Skyline does have some gore.
OK, well, this is like a bonus DVD extra,
exactly,
then. OK, this is clearly an exclusive just for the podcast. If you don't like the gore,
If you don't like the gore and you don't want the cake,
yes,
then I'd go for Skyline.
Mark, it's been a privilege and an honour as ever. Thank you so much.
It's strange, isn't it? In the words of Vinnie Jones,
it's been emotional. Thank you so much for being with me this week.
No, thank you so much for being with me. And I particularly enjoyed seeing a film with you.
Thank you. By the way,
we should do it again.
Yes. And the polo neck?
You don't like it?
No. Well, it's nice. It always means love bites, though.
No, it didn't.
Okay.
Well, that was as a school kid, if you're wearing a polo neck, you've had love bites.
But when you get to
middle age, that's why I never wore a polo neck at school.
It's just saggy neck.
Okay, yeah, saggy neck, chicken neck. Thank you.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.